This is Sarah McLennan doing an oral history interview with Stella Staley on January 29th, 2002, about her service in the U.S. military waves during World War II for A Few Good Women, The Role of Women in the Military During the Second World War, a project through the Michigan Women's Historical Center and Hall of Fame.
Okay, so we just have to keep an eye on this to make sure that our tape doesn't run out. But
okay.
The first question we were wondering about is, why did you decide to enlist?
Well, I grew up with a dad who'd been in World War I and had the Purple Heart and very military type, you know. And so he belonged to an American Legion. He was a charter member of the American Legion and belonged to a drum and bugle corps for years. So we used to travel with him a lot when they would have events, you know, around the, I'm from the east, around the eastern part of the country. And then when I was 12, I joined a girls drum and bugle corps, and until I was 18, 6 years. So I knew all about drilling and all the types of things that the military do. So when the war came along, I wanted to join. It was, I guess, I graduated in June of 41, and December, of course, of 41 was Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And the only thing is that I wasn't old enough. And so I worked for a while. And then eventually, the age for the U.S. Navy, or U.S. Naval Reserve, actually, the waves, was lowered to age 20. So the minute I heard this, I headed for Boston, Massachusetts, and enlisted. This was in March of, 43. And I was called to active duty in May of 43, and I was in until June of 1945.
Okay. Was your father in the Navy also?
No, he was in the Army, which is strange that I wouldn't have been wanted. I could have joined, he said, in the WACS, you could join at 18,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't want to be in the Army. I'd always thought, and I was kind of ahead of my time, I used to think how I'd love to go to the Annapolis. I used to go see the movies and everything, you know, and I just had a love for the Navy. And also, they had better looking uniforms.
So how did you hear about the waves, or with information? Was it really present, or did you go to a recruiting station, or?
No. Just heard on the radio that the you know, the age had been lowered, and I just knew that you had to go to Boston in order. I lived in New Hampshire, so mm-hmm. about 90 miles away. You had to go to Boston to recruit and or to enlist, and I just did it.
So how did your family and the community, your friends, respond to your enlistment?
Well, I think a lot of them were surprised as far as friends or relatives, because I was an only child. And they were very supportive, and especially my dad was very proud because he didn't have a son to go into the service. And so he was very proud, and my mother was too. And so they took it very well. But I think some of my friends were, I mean, they thought that, I think there were only two of us who joined the service in the town that I lived in. So when I would come home occasionally on leave, you know, I was treated like a queen. No, everyone was very supportive.
Did you discuss it with your family before you decided, or did you kind of make the decision?
Well, I had discussed it for 2 years before.
So you'd been waiting, right, so they already knew.
They knew the first chance I had. I did think at one time joining the Canadian Navy, because I had a lot of relatives up there, and I spent some time up there. But then that was in 41, and then I was told, and to this day I don't know if that was the truth or not, but that after we get in the war, after December 7th, that if anyone joined another country's service, like, you know, Canada's, they would lose their citizenship. And so I didn't want to do that.
No, definitely not. So what was it like being in a majorly male environment?
Well, when I was first in, after I left boot camp, that was at Hunter College in Bronx, New York, and I received my rating at that time. They were given tests, and in Norfolk, Virginia, at the receiving station, they needed help very quickly to release some of the men. And so we went down there, and there were only 13 of us. And we did not have any women officers. We had the men officers because Smith College had not graduated enough officers to go around yet. This was right in the beginning, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the officers especially, but everybody was very protective. And it continued that way. I mean, you never had any problem. I mean, they treated you as equal. And if anybody made any comment, if anybody swore or something, somebody would just really correct them and remind them that there were women present, you know. And so it didn't seem very strange at all. Eventually, of course, there were about 200 of us there, you know, so, mm-hmm. but we were still very outnumbered. But I never thought of it as being strange or, you know, unusual.
Mm-hmm. What's the... So were there any stereotypes about military women or women in the military that you encountered?
Well, the only stereotypes that I know about and that I, you know, did hear is that women who were in the military were promiscuous and that, you know, the men harassed them. But in my case, I never saw any of that, and I don't think any of my friends where we were stationed, the men were very protective, and we never had any problem like that at all. Mm-hmm. I guess in recent years, there has been some problems, and I know that a friend recently called and told me that she was so sorry for me that I'd had to go through all this all those years ago, and I laughed about that because I never went through anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So you never really encountered that at all with
No,
anyone?
I never encountered it at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was your training like, and who were you trained by?
Well, my training was at Hunter College in Bronx, New York. It lasted for 6 weeks, and it was called boot camp, of course, and it was very tough. We had classes and four or five classes a day, and then we had a lot of drilling. And the drilling especially was bad because when I was there, it was very, very hot. And if anyone fainted in front of you, you just walked right over them. At the time that I was there, they were using Marines who were on R&R, which is rest and recreation, who had been on Guadalcanal. And of course, the Marines didn't care much for the Navy, and they especially didn't care much for women in the service. So they were pretty hard on us. We were there for 6 weeks. During that time, we had a few famous stars or famous musicians that would come and, you know, give a show. But that was about the only entertainment that we had. So in order to be able to get out at least once a week, maybe more if possible, I decided to work on the newspaper. They had a newspaper that they put out, and somehow I ended up being the assistant editor. The only experience I'd had had been in high school on the yearbook and magazine that we put out, and also, you know, that small things. But it was one way of getting out, and I really enjoyed it. Since we were in a college, Hunter College, there were no barracks, and so we lived in apartments that had been converted, and this was really rough on the people. What they had done when they evicted hundreds of people who lived in apartments surrounding the college, they gave them just about 2 or 3 weeks' notice to move. They found other places for the people to live, but maybe not as handy as what these apartments had been. And so when I went there, it was still early on, and they had stripped everything out of the apartments, and all we had were bunks and a couple of chairs and a dresser. And as far as eating, we ate in the, had been the college's cafeteria. after 6 weeks, I was received my petty officer third class as a yeoman third class and was sent directly to Norfolk, Virginia to the receiving station there. In Norfolk, we lived in a barracks. There were only 13 of us in a barracks that held 200 people. And we did not have any women officers because there had not been enough of them that had been trained at Smith College to go around. So we had to wait 3 months before we had our own officers. In the meantime, the officers, the male officers, the head ones, the commanding officer and the executive officer were in charge of us. And they were very, very strict because they didn't want, you know, anything to happen to us.
Mm-hmm. What were your duties in Norfolk and what kind of things were you doing there?
Well, I was assigned to the legal division, the disciplinary section. And most of my work was in with court martials and discharges, dishonorable discharges, and anything to do with the law, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it started out in June of 43. And then a few months later, I don't remember the exact month, in my service record, I had, you were asked, you know, what talents you might have, that type of thing. And I had put down that I was planning on being a French and Latin teacher and that I was fluent in French. In fact, I didn't speak English until I started school.
Oh.
And so later I wished I had never put that down there, but I had. And of course I'd also put down that I'd been drum and bugle corps, so then I had a lot to do with drilling, but that was back in boot camp. But anyway, so I was called into the executive officer's office. And they were expecting the Free French had gone to North Africa, the ones that had escaped from France when France fell. And so we were going to help them with this Lend-Lease. And so they were going to have a lot of these French sailors and their officers coming in. They were going to stay at our base, and they wanted me to be an interpreter for them. And so I did that from, I guess it must have been the fall of 43 until, a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty exciting, and it was pretty scary, actually, because I remember the first time that I did it, I was told to go to the mess hall, and a Marine guard carrying a submachine gun, I think it was, you know, accompanied me and stood next to me while I sat at a table. And they opened up the doors, and these men started coming in, these French ones. And they were from, I think they were from Indochina. And they spoke French with a Chinese accent. And they were all illiterate. And what I was supposed to do, we were going to, the immigration required that there'd be something in writing that they'd been in the country, but then they were sending them back out too. And so most of them just put it, and I couldn't figure out they couldn't spell their names. I couldn't
mm-hmm.
figure it out either. Most of them just put an X down, but it was kind of scary. Another time I had a group that came in that looked like something out of a B pirate movie. Some had patches, striped shirts. They all carried, or most of them carried, these small wicker suitcases. And of course they had to open them up. And usually there'd be maybe a shirt in there, but always a bottle of rum. That's how they carried their rum. And these people were all from ships that had been sunk in the Atlantic and very close to the United States, actually, much closer than most, you know, people knew.
Mm-hmm.
Then I also interpreted for the Free French who had come out of North Africa and were brought to this country to be outfitted and sent back out on ships that we were lending them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time that I did it for these French people, there was only one man who spoke a little English, but very little. And so they had them all lined up, and I was supposed to get their sizes to see, you know, what size uniforms that, you know, we would furnish them. The uniforms we furnished them, all anything that had anything to do with it, you know, like U.S. or Navy, U.S. Navy, everything had been taken off so that they were just plain uniforms. And so anyway, they lined them all up, and the first one that came up to my table, I asked him, I don't remember, I think I asked him his size shoes first, if I remember right, and I think he said something like a 96 or something. And I thought he was just being funny, you know. It turned out that all they could tell me was in metric.
Oh, in the European
I had never
sizes.
Had any metric, you know. And so finally, between this one officer that they had with them, we managed to get through it. But it was a chore, you know, like the fellow had 120 chests, or I don't even remember, you know, now, because I still don't know metric. But anyway, and that was that was really tough that day. But we managed to get through it. In the meantime, I somehow, I don't remember how I did it, I made myself up a chart with the different sizes and what the metric number would be, so I wouldn't run into that again. And I had a lot of these fellows that, you know, that came in, and some of them were so young. Of course, we had a lot of young sailors too, but they seemed so much younger. And I remember I was very light blonde, and I remember this huge group that came in. They were there quite a few months. They only had one young man that was blonde haired, so he sort of attached himself to me. I mean, he seemed like a kid at the time, you know, and because very unusual, French people are usually dark.
Right.
But he was, and my ancestors were from Normandy, and where there's a difference there. There's a mixture, I guess, with German, and that's how you get the lighter skin and the lighter hair, you know. I guess I worked with other groups too, but I did work with them more than any.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, after a few months, they were ready to go back out, and they were given or lent a destroyer escort. It was called a DE. It was a DE Somalie. And so before they were supposed to leave, their commanding officer, and I have the pictures and everything of this man and some of his crew. He had been a banker in Marseille. And so anyway, he sent a note to my commanding officer wanting me to, they wanted to honor me at a dinner on board their ship before they left to thank me for what I had done. And of course, my commanding officer would not allow that unless someone went with me. And well, there wasn't anybody else that I could think of except that my best friend, who happened to be from Czechoslovakia, she had had French in school but didn't know very much of it. So we sort of stretched it a little bit, and she went with me. And so we had this, I think it was a 5 or 6 course dinner.
Wow.
And with wine all the time, and I was not a wine drinker. I remember different kinds of wine, you know. And then they had the ceremony making me the patroness of this DE escort, you know, destroyer escort, which was quite an honor.
Mm-hmm.
And
I bet.
At the time, I was a yeoman. By that time, I think I was a yeoman second class, which is usually just, you know, office-type work. And sometime during the time I was doing this, right way back in the beginning, actually, my exec had called me to his office, and he wanted to know if I would want to go to Smith College to officers' training school. And which was quite a surprise, but the reason that they were doing this or wanted to do it was because there was no rating in the waves in the you know, non-officers, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
For interpreting, there was for men, but there wasn't
but not for
women.
The women.
And so he wanted me to go there for a few weeks, and I would have become an ensign.
Were there any other women that were doing translating, or were you working with other men doing it? Or was it pretty much you by yourself?
Mm-hmm. I was on my own, yeah. And there might have been at other bases, you
right,
know, but most of them came into this receiving station mm-hmm. where I was.
So it was kind of like there was a need and you had the skills to fill it, and so that's
yes.
how you ended up.
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody evidently looked through the service records of the people that they had there, and they
right.
saw this, you know. And
they thought, perfect.
And of course, you never thought of saying no. I mean, you didn't have much chance
right.
of saying no. But so he asked me to think about it. Right away, I knew I didn't want to go. But he asked me to think about it for a few days. And I even remember his name was Commander McDonald. Funny how you remember names like that. But anyway, so then I went back and told him that I didn't want to.
And didn't you really want to go?
Well, because for one thing, the non-coms, as we were called, non-commissioned officers like we were, didn't like the offices very much.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I had a lot of friends, especially the 13 of us who had stuck together. We were like a club, you know, and the time we had been there. And I just figured my friends would drop me. I wouldn't have friends anymore. And I just didn't want to be an officer.
So when you went back to see him again?
So I went back to see him, and when I told him this, he was very upset. And in fact, he was from not quite a neighboring state, but he was a Yankee too. I was from New Hampshire and he was from Rhode Island. So he felt like we had something in common, you know. And he never was as friendly after that with me, you know. But actually, even years later, I wasn't sorry that I did, you know, did do that.
Right. So I wanted to ask you about your surroundings at Norfolk, and also if you felt in danger at all. I know you weren't overseas, but...
Well, I didn't feel in danger until I started doing working with the French.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that there were a lot of our ships, and ships from other countries too, that were being sunk by German submarines. Within not too many miles from our shoreline.
And this wasn't something that was commonly known?
No, it was not at all known, and during the time that I was interpreting, I was sworn to secrecy, that I could not divulge any of this. And one thing that I remember that after the first month that I did this interpreting, I lost 9 pounds. So I don't think I was eating very well. I was pretty nervous, because sometimes I'd have to interpret between my commanding officer and one of the higher-ups of the French officers, you know, that
mm-hmm.
would come in. And all this was, you know, very hush-hush.
Right.
And so you get pretty jittery.
A little bit of pressure
afraid,
there.
Well, I was afraid that I would interpret something, you know,
incorrectly.
Yeah. And I don't know what I thought I would cause, but anyway, that was the only danger. But
right.
And as far as my daily routine, I worked in the legal section in the mornings, and then in the afternoon I worked in my interpreting. Not every day, because sometimes there wouldn't be any groups coming in, or the groups that were there didn't need anything. But for a little over a year there, that was pretty much, you know, my routine.
Mm-hmm. And you never stopped your legal work. You kept doing that.
No. Uh-huh.
Okay. So you're going to describe your uniforms that you had, and you said there are three or four different ones.
Well, yes. When I was at boot camp, when we were issued our uniforms, they were a cotton gabardine, and they were the most horrible-looking uniforms that you ever saw. They just had, they were shapeless, and they wrinkled, and they were hot. And here we were going down to Virginia, where it was very hot anyway, but that's the only uniforms that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And we only had one uniform and one hat. That's all that had been issued to us, because the manufacturers, you know, couldn't make them fast enough,
right.
I guess. I only had that uniform for maybe 6 months, or I'm not sure it's now. But then they did issue us the regular wool serge uniform, and they were really beautiful. Ours, different stores like Saks, and I think it was Bloomingdale's and Macy's, they're the ones that took over having these manufactured for us. And they were very good looking uniforms. The first hats that we had was a navy brim, and you had different attachments, tops to it. You'd have white most of the time. In the wintertime, the top would be a navy top.
Mm-hmm.
And you even had a rain hat that went over that. And you had white shirts, and you had bright blue shirts, too. Those were the work shirts. And then you had the navy shirts, two different colors. And it would depend what you were doing that day, what was going on, you know, which color you were told to wear. In boot camp, you had to have very sensible shoes. They looked like something my grandmother would have worn. They were laced, of course, with a kind of a medium heel. But the minute we got to our stations, we put those away. The only time we'd have them, every Friday, we'd have to have an inspection. We'd have to stand by our bunks, and everything was inspected with white gloves, and you had to be in the proper uniform. And so that's when we'd wear them. But otherwise, we all wore pumps, black pumps, and it made us feel a little bit better.
So yeah, you wanted to wear the more stylish shoes. And it it wasn't a problem for any of the work you were doing or mm-hmm. anything like that.
Oh, no. Well, it might have been for some.
For some,
depending.
But,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, like some of them that worked in the Naval Air Station, I had friends there. I mean, they were... then in the next summer, they came out with seersucker uniforms for a summer uniform. And those were dressed with kind of a little round collar. Of course, we wore black ties always with all uniforms, and then it had a jacket that fitted over it, and so that was a lot more comfortable, and you didn't have to iron them for one thing, I mean, have them pressed. And there also was a white uniform, and that was optional. You didn't have to have that, and if you did want it, you had to buy it, and it was worn for special occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I bought one. Not with my pay, because I was only making $96 a month, but I get money from my folks,
right.
And I bought that. The other thing that we had, too, that was issued to us was a gabardine navy raincoat, a belted raincoat, which was a real good-looking coat. But in Norfolk, being as near the ocean as we were, it was very, very cold in the wintertime. I mean, it was so damp. And so you had the option of buying, I think it was what they call a wool melton. It was a heavy, heavy winter coat with a half belt. And a few of us did get those, and mm-hmm. I was one of them. Mm-hmm. And on the hats, after about a year or so, they came out with overseas caps. And those were much more attractive than those awful hats that we had in the beginning. And on the front of the overseas cap, we had our Navy pin, which is an anchor,
mm-hmm.
in gold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I felt real good about wearing the uniform. It was a very good looking uniform, and I was very proud to wear it.
Was there any emphasis on you being feminine or looking ladylike? Did they have regulations about how to wear your hair or makeup or jewelry?
Yes, your skirt had to be just below your knees. And your hair had to be above your collar. Those are about the only, well, of course, you always had to be in uniform.
Right.
And you, as far as jewelry, I wore a watch. We didn't wear any chains or necklaces or anything like that. Rings and a watch you could wear.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I remember that we used to do when we would get paid, we would always go to the best department store in town and buy something feminine. We, you know, like we'd buy perfume, or we would buy real fancy underwear, because there were no rules about the underwear we wore,
mm-hmm.
as there was in the Army. That was one reason I didn't want to join the Army.
Oh,
I
really?
Think.
They had underwear regulations.
I had to wear khaki.
Oh my!
Yeah, and I didn't want to wear that. But so we'd always buy something, you know, real frilly, and the perfume I remember especially. I mean, just so we could continue to feel feminine.
To feel,
you know,
feminine.
In fact, I remember one time my parents were coming down from New Hampshire to spend Christmas with me, and so this friend and I had rented an apartment for them to stay in, because it was impossible in those days to get into a hotel. They were all taken up by military, you know. Mm-hmm. And we rented it from this woman in a real nice part of town. And we had to rent it for a longer period than they were there. And so we decided in the evening when we could get out, we would go there and just, you know, feel like we were civilians again.
Right.
And I remember one time we decided to bleach each other's hair. And we had never done it, didn't know anything about it, and it was a real big mess. But what I remember the most, I think, is because since my folks were coming for Christmas, we wanted a Christmas tree. And we couldn't figure out how we were going to get a Christmas tree, but we went downtown on a trolley. They had trolleys in Norfolk in those days, and found a place that was selling trees and bought this tree and got it back on a trolley and took it back to this apartment. And then we didn't have anything to put it in, so the lady gave us a pail, and I don't know what we put in for weight. And I remember we didn't have any decorations to speak of, but we had a lot of bowls. I think she gave us some, and we'd been getting presents or something. Mm-hmm. So we decorated the tree with these Christmas bows. And I think popcorn, if I remember right, you know. And, you know, to this day, it's the best tree I ever had.
The improvised one.
Yeah, we really improvised that one.
That's neat.
Okay. And of course, they expected us to be ladylike, and whether we were, you know, on base or wherever we were, that we were representing the Navy, and we should do it the best that we could possibly do it.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much like feminine, but it was like to be, you know, look neat and clean and be mm-hmm. like a lady and.
Yeah, it wasn't feminine or it wasn't anti-feminine either. It was just expect us to be normal.
Be normal.
I can't think of any other word, you know.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Would you serve again? Or?
Yeah. So this is kind of a wrap-up. I was wondering how you felt about your experience overall. Would you do it again? And just any kind of thing about the end of your service or anything like that that you'd like to add?
Well, I feel real good about my experience. And I certainly would serve again if I was young enough to do so. Now, I was married while I was in the Navy. I was from New Hampshire, and I married someone from Saginaw, Michigan. That's how I ended up
in
Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so we met because we both did the same kind of legal work, but he was at a different base. But we used to have a contact quite often, either on the phone or in person, and that's how we met. And so we were married in February 8th of 1945, and because the war was kind of winding up already.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I became pregnant within 2-3 months, I guess, 2 months probably. And but had planned, we knew that in those days, if you had so many points, it made a difference as to when you'd be out of the service. He knew that he had enough because he'd been on a ship that had been sunk and he'd worked up a lot of points. He knew that he was going to be discharged in September mm-hmm. of 45. And so this is June of 45, and I planned on, now we lived off base at that time.
So
I mean,
once you got married, you could live together.
We had a two-room apartment, uh-huh. And so anyway, I planned on staying in when I got pregnant. Because we needed the money to go home and get started until September when he'd be released. Well, one morning I was in what they call, the Navy calls it the head, was in the bathroom, and I don't think I was actually sick, but I guess I didn't look very good, and as I came out I met one of the women officers, and she looked me right in the eye and said, "Are you pregnant?" And I couldn't lie.
Right.
I suppose I should have, but I didn't. I couldn't lie, so I said yes. This was about 8:30 in the morning, and I was out of there by 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow.
I was never even told that I was entitled to carry on my $5,000 life insurance policy. I wasn't given any of my medals, nothing. I just went through all these doctors, went through this whole big physical, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out because in those days, nowadays it's entirely different.
Right.
You know, you can have children, you have a family. But in those days, boy, you just, so anyway, so from June until my husband was discharged, I sat in a very hot two-room apartment on the second floor where, I mean, there was no air conditioning then
right.
or anything, you know, and it wasn't very pleasant. Well, then we you know, we went. So then in September he was released, and we went to New Hampshire, to my hometown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think about women in the military today? Do you have any opinions or feelings about women in combat, or what kind of roles they should play now?
Well, I believe there is a future, and there should be a future of women in the military. I don't really agree with some of it. As far as women in combat, like hand-to-hand combat or right in the danger zone, mm-hmm. no, I don't believe in that. And of course, war in general. Now, I know that just recently I saw a pilot, a woman pilot on TV. I guess she was... she'd been in, you know, for quite a while. But as far as, like, their training, they have to, I mean, it's pretty rough. Mm-hmm. I mean, now, because they're being trained for war.
Right.
And, of course, the Navy isn't as bad as if, you know, somebody is in the Army. Mm-hmm. But I believe they should be able to go overseas and, you know, be backup for the men that they can be released for, you know, for war duty, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they should be right in the thick of it,
mm-hmm.
which is not the feminist way to feel, I guess.
Right, but, you know, it's everyone's personal opinion,
yeah.
And so everybody has a different view on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we were just curious to know what yours was.